Vekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. We're here to take those big influential ideas, the ones that really affect how we see things, and, well, break them down for you.
And today we're getting into a really major work in social psychology. It's a book that honestly shifted how we think about influence. Robert Cialdini's Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion.
Yeah, and it feels more important now than ever, doesn't it? I mean, look around. Everything's so complex, so much information flying at us.
Oh, absolutely. Thousands of messages daily, right? Yeah. All wanting something from you, wanting a decision.
You can't possibly analyze every single one.
Exactly. Your brain just can't cope. So we lean on these mental shortcuts, heuristics, you know, to make quick calls.
Right.
And Cialdini's book, it's like a crucial guide to these shortcuts. A bit alarming, actually, because it shows how they're used, targeted even by what he calls compliance professionals.
So our job today is kind of give you the shortcut to the shortcuts. We want to pull out Cialdini's 6 main weapons of influence.
These are the triggers, the things that shape your decisions, often without you even realizing it.
Yeah, the goal is to help you recognize them so you can keep control over your choices.
Okay, so let's start with the man himself, Dr. Robert Cialdini. He's a highly respected American social psychologist, professor emeritus at Arizona State, very rigorous academic background.
But the thing that makes his work so compelling, so real world, is how he researched it. He didn't just stay in the lab, did he?
No way. That's the legendary part. He actually spent 3 years basically undercover.
Undercover doing what?
He got right in there. Trained and worked as a used car salesman, a fundraiser, a telemarketer.
Wow.
Yeah, he wanted to see how these persuasion tactics really work, you know, out in the wild, not just in theory.
So he wasn't just studying influence, he was living it, seeing it from both sides.
Exactly. That mix of hardcore research and actually being in the trenches, it gives him this incredible credibility. He knows how it feels when these techniques are used on you.
Okay, so what's the main idea of the book then, the core argument?
Well, Cialdini says our behavior often runs on these predictable, almost mechanical psychological principles. He has this great metaphor for it. Click whir.
Click whir. Okay, explain that.
So the click is the trigger, the right cue.
Yeah.
And when that happens, this pre-programmed mental tape, the whir, just automatically starts playing.
Ah, like an instinct.
Sort of. Like if the cue is, hey, everyone else is doing this, the whir response is often, okay, then I guess that's what I should do too, without much thought.
And he found specific triggers for that?
Yes. He identified 6 main ones,
yeah.
6 universally reliable cues that kick off that automatic whir response. These are the 6 weapons. Reciprocation.
Commitment and consistency.
Social proof.
Liking.
Authority.
And scarcity.
And it's really key to remember, this book is meant to be like self-defense.
Right. It's about awareness.
Exactly. Making those automatic triggers conscious. So you can hit pause on the whir, think for a second, and decide based on whether the request actually makes sense, not just because you got manipulated.
Okay, let's dive into the first weapon then, reciprocation.
Right, this is that really deep-seated feeling, that obligation we have to give back when someone gives us something.
It makes sense. Society kind of relies on that, doesn't it? Give and take.
Totally, it's essential. But here's the twist. It's power. Can create what Cialdini calls uninvited debts.
Uninvited debts?
Yeah. Someone gives you something small, something you didn't even ask for, like a free flower at the airport from the Hare Krishnas. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. I remember that example.
Or a free sample. Suddenly, you feel this psychological weight, this obligation to give something back. And often, you end up giving back more than what you got just to get rid of that uncomfortable feeling of owing someone.
So you're manipulated into overpaying, basically. Which leads to that tactic, rejection, then retreat.
Exactly, the door in the face technique.
How does that work again?
So the person asks for something huge first, something they know you'll say no to. Like maybe a Boy Scout asks you to buy a $5 ticket to some event.
Okay, I say no.
Then they immediately retreat to a much smaller request. Okay, well, how about buying one of these $1 candy bars then?
Ah.
Because they made a concession, coming down from $5 to $1, you feel this pressure to reciprocate their concession by agreeing to the smaller thing.
Even if I didn't want the candy bar in the first place.
Precisely. You've been guilted into it by the principle of reciprocity.
Okay, that's powerful, but it seems very immediate, very emotional. What about longer-term influence? If I agree to an idea, not just take a gift.
Well, that leads us right into the second weapon, commitment and consistency. This is our deep, almost obsessive need to be and to look consistent with what we've already said or done.
We like to think of ourselves as consistent people, right? It feels good.
It does. It saves mental energy. Yeah. We don't have to rethink things. And, you know, society tends to value people who are consistent. Flip-floppers don't get much respect.
So where's the catch? How is that exploited?
The vulnerability comes after you've made a commitment.
Yeah.
Especially if you've done it actively, like writing it down or publicly, or if it took some effort.
Okay.
Once that's happened, we'll bend over backwards, rationalize almost anything, even bad decisions, just to stay consistent with that initial stand.
Right.
And that's the engine behind the foot-in-the-door technique.
Get a small yes first.
Exactly. Get someone to agree to something small, maybe sign a petition or put a small sticker in their window. That subtly changes how they see themselves. I'm the kind of person who supports this cause.
And then you come back with the bigger ask.
Yep. And compliance goes way up because they need to act consistently with that new self-image they just adopted.
The toy company example in the book is just brutal for this one.
Oh, yeah. Remind us how that works.
They advertise a super popular toy before Christmas, get kids wanting it, but then they deliberately don't stock enough.
Right. So parents promise the toy.
Can't find it anywhere, have to buy substitute gifts instead. But they promised. Then, come January, the stores are suddenly full of the original toy and the ads start up again. And the parents, feeling bound by that earlier promise, trudge back to the store and buy the toy they couldn't get before.
Doubling the company's sales, essentially. All because the parents needed to stay consistent with their commitment to their child. It's quite something.
It really is. Okay, so if consistency is about staying true to ourselves, what's next? Social proof. That seems more outward looking.
Exactly. Social proof is all about looking to others to figure out what's right. The basic rule is we decide what's correct by seeing what other people think is correct.
Herd mentality, basically.
Kind of, yeah. It's especially powerful in two situations. When we're uncertain or the situation is ambiguous.
Makes sense. If you don't know what to do, you look around.
Right. And second, when we see people who are similar to us doing something, we tend to follow the lead of people we perceive as being like us.
And this can have really serious consequences, can't it? Like the bystander effect.
Oh, absolutely terrifying. The classic Catherine Genovese case, where many people witnessed an attack, but nobody intervened.
Why does that happen?
Cialdini points to social proof and pluralistic ignorance. In an ambiguous emergency, everyone looks to see how others are reacting. But since everyone else is also looking around, appearing calm,
the signal everyone gets is, oh, nobody else is panicking, so maybe it's not a real emergency.
Exactly. The social proof is that doing nothing is the correct response, even if deep down people feel something is wrong.
That's chilling. Even on a smaller scale, like canned laughter on TV shows.
Perfect example. We know it's fake, right?
Yeah.
Intellectually.
Yeah.
But hearing that laughter track still provides social proof that the jokes are funny. And research shows it actually makes people rate the show as funnier and laugh more themselves.
Our brains just want to follow the crowd, even a fake one.
It seems so. We're wired to outsource our thinking sometimes.
Yeah.
Which brings us nicely to the fourth weapon, liking.
This one feels obvious. We prefer to say yes to people we know and like.
It does seem obvious, but compliance pros don't leave liking to chance. They actively work to make you like them.
How? What are the triggers?
Well, physical attractiveness is a big one, the halo effect. We tend to unconsciously assume attractive people are also smarter, kinder, more honest.
Wow, okay.
Similarity is another huge factor. We like people who are like us or who seem like us. Salespeople are trained to find common ground, hobbies, background, anything.
The compliments work too, right? Even if they feel a bit fake.
Surprisingly, yes. Even insincere flattery can create a feeling of liking and obligation. And finally, contact and cooperation, just being familiar with someone or working together towards a common goal, increases liking.
The Tupperware party example pulls a lot of this together, doesn't it?
It's the masterclass. Mm-hmm. Think about it. The request to buy comes from the hostess, who's your friend, liking.
Right.
There are games and free gifts, reciprocity. You see your other friends buying the products, social proof. And often, people are asked to share how much they love their Tupperware. Commitment and consistency. It bundles multiple weapons into one event. Very effective.
Okay, moving on. Weapon number 5, authority. This feels like a big one.
It is. It's about our deep-seated, almost automatic obedience to figures of authority.
Yeah.
It's drilled into us from childhood, obey parents, teachers, police.
And we don't always need the actual authority, right? Just the symbols.
Exactly. That's the scary part. Often it's just the trappings of authority that trigger our compliance. Things like titles, doctor, professor.
Or uniforms, lab coats, expensive suits.
Even status symbols like fancy cars. These symbols can be enough to make us switch off our critical thinking and just obey.
The Milgram experiment is the absolute classic study here, isn't it?
It really is. It's profoundly disturbing. People were willing to administer what they thought were incredibly painful, even dangerous electric shocks to another person.
Just because a guy in a lab coat told him to keep going.
A staggering number of them went all the way. It shows the immense pressure we feel to obey someone we perceive as a legitimate authority, even when it conflicts with our own conscience.
Cialdini also tells that story, the rectal earache one.
Oh, yes. It's less traumatic than Milgram, but maybe even more chilling in a way because it's so mundane.
Remind me what happened.
A doctor wrote an ambiguous prescription for ear drops for a patient with an ear infection. He abbreviated right ear as our ear. The nurse read it as rear.
Oh, no. Don't tell me.
Yep. Conditioned to follow doctor's orders without question, she administered the ear drops into the patient's rectum.
You're kidding.
I wish I were. Her deference to the symbol of authority, the doctor's order, completely shut down her common sense. It shows how automatic that obedience can be.
Wow. That's, yeah, unbelievable. Last weapon, scarcity.
Right. The scarcity principle. Basically, opportunities seem much more valuable to us when their availability is limited.
Limited time offer, only 3 left in stock.
Exactly those. We are just wired to be more motivated by the thought of losing something than by the thought of gaining something of equal value. Loss aversion.
So why does that work? What's the psychology?
It's linked to something called psychological reactance. When our freedom to have something is limited or threatened,
we react by wanting it even more.
Precisely. It's like a toddler who suddenly wants the toy that's taken away. The item itself hasn't changed, but because it's becoming unavailable, its perceived value shoots up. We want to preserve our freedom of choice.
And Cialdini calls that the Romeo and Juliet effect, right?
Yeah, a great example. Parental opposition to a teenage romance often just makes the couple more determined to be together.
Because the relationship itself becomes a scarce, forbidden thing.
Exactly. The scarcity intensifies the desire. It's all about that fear of missing out, the fear of loss.
Okay, that's a powerful set of tools.
Yeah.
If we had to boil it down, what are the really key themes or messages we should take away from all this?
I think the first big one is understanding the double-edged sword of these mental shortcuts. They're absolutely necessary, right? We couldn't function without them.
We'd be paralyzed by analysis.
Totally. But that very efficiency creates these predictable weak spots, these vulnerabilities that can be exploited, like automatically thinking expensive good is good and buying something you don't need.
Right. And the second takeaway?
For me, it's just how automatic and mindless our compliance often is. That click were idea is so central.
Like that study where just using the word because worked.
Yeah, the Ellen Langer Xerox machine study. People were much more likely to let someone cut in line if they said, excuse me, may I use the Xerox machine because I have to make copies.
Which is not even a real reason.
It's a completely redundant reason. But the word because itself acted as the click, triggering the were of automatic compliance. It shows how easily our rational brain can be bypassed.
So if we're often on autopilot, what's the defense?
And that's the third key message. Awareness is your number one shield. Cialdini is essentially giving us influence literacy.
It's not about rejecting these principles entirely.
No, not at all. Reciprocity is good. Listening to real experts is good. It's about learning to spot when these triggers are being used illegitimately to manipulate you.
So you can pause, step back, and think, wait a minute, does this request actually have merit?
Precisely. You regain control.
The book has some really memorable ways of phrasing these ideas. Can we share a few key quotes or paraphrased ideas?
Definitely. On reciprocity, a core idea is the rule of reciprocity is so powerful that it creates uninvited debts and can trigger unequal exchanges. Meaning you could be pushed into owing someone, then pushed into overpaying.
Yeah, that uninvited debt concept is huge. And on automaticity.
The power of simple triggers. The word because triggers an automatic compliance response, even if the reason given is not a good one. It just highlights how easily we can be short-circuited.
And for scarcity, that powerful motivator.
Cialdini quotes, I think, of G.K. Chesterton, "The way to love anything is to realize that it might be lost." It really captures that loss aversion. The fear of losing something motivates us more strongly than the hope of gaining it.
Okay, let's make this really practical. How can people use this knowledge day to day, like defending against scarcity tactics?
Okay, so you feel that pressure, that limited time offer rush. The key is to consciously pause. Stop. Ask yourself, do I want this thing for its own sake because it's genuinely useful or desirable?
Or
do I mainly want it because it's scarce, because I'm afraid I'll miss out? If it's mostly the scarcity talking, you should probably walk away. Separate the desire for the item from the thrill of the chase.
Good advice. What about using these principles ethically, say, in a professional setting?
Well, take commitment and consistency. If you're a manager trying to get your team on board with a big project, don't just drop it on them.
Use the foot in the door.
Ethically, yes. Start by getting their agreement on a smaller related point first. Maybe get everyone to publicly commit, even in writing, to one small initial step or principle related to the goal.
So they make a small commitment first.
Right. That makes it psychologically easier for them to align with the bigger goal later, because they want to remain consistent with that initial public stance.
And dealing with authority, how do we question an expert without being dismissive?
It's a balance. You don't want to ignore genuine expertise, but you need critical thinking. Cialdini suggests asking two key questions. First, is this authority truly an expert in this specific area?
Not just generally smart, but relevant expertise.
Exactly. And second, how trustworthy is this expert likely to be here? Do they have anything to gain personally if I follow their advice?
Ah, checking for vested interests.
Right. It helps you separate the message from the messenger's potential biases or the symbols they carry.
So, wrapping up, what was the biggest thing that struck you revisiting this material?
For me, it's always that humbling reminder of how irrational we often are, how much we operate on that click-we're autopilot. It's less about thinking we're smart and more about recognizing our built-in vulnerabilities. It's kind of empowering in a weird way, knowing where your weak spots are.
Yeah, I agree. My main takeaway is similar. It's like gaining this controlled skepticism. You start seeing these principles in action everywhere. A free sample, a testimonial, a limited time sale. It's not cynical exactly, but you see them as potential triggers now, not just neutral information.
It gives you back that moment of choice.
Exactly. It equips you to be a more conscious decision maker, to protect your freedom to choose based on the merits. It's a really valuable skill set in today's world. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.